So we are convened this morning to look at three bills. First, we have a work session on Senate Bill 686. So I convene the work session on Senate Bill 686. Colleagues, there's been some discussion about prison siting issues and possible resolution of those issues. The speaker has indicated to me she would like to see resolution of those issues, but she also does not believe that they can be resolved quickly today, the one day that we are reopened. And she has asked that we consider moving this bill to the Rules Committee, which stays open, so that we'd have an opportunity to work with the governor on solutions. I see Representative Crummell out there. Representative Crummell, did you want to come forward for a moment? Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jerry Crummell. I'm the state representative from House District 27. I would encourage the committee to go ahead and move Senate Bill 686 over to Rules. The prison siting issue is one that, as you well know, has been contentious, and I think that there are some issues that need to be resolved before anything can be done on that, and so I would encourage your aye vote and appreciate you moving it over to Rules so that it can be worked on there. Thank you.
Thank you. I would indicate, too, I've talked to Steve Marks from the governor's office, and he understands this and is supportive of us continuing to try to resolve this issue by keeping that bill alive in an open committee. So I would entertain a motion that we transfer Senate Bill 686 to Rules with no recommendation.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman has made the motion. Representative Hansen.
Is there any intention to do, will this be a at Rules, will this be a total gut and stuff? Are we reading?
That's a good question.
With the relating clause?
The relating clause will be in Rules and available for total gut and stuff. It's also possible that if there is a compromise about some of the issues that were in Senate 6 Bill 86, they could still be left in the bill. And I've had a conversation with Mr. Linden this morning, for instance, and there is some indication that some of those issues have been worked out, and that they were still interested in preserving some of those. I'm open to that. And there are other bills in this committee which we could be reopened for, too, which may have appropriate relating clauses. The short answer is yes, that's still a possibility. Any further discussion on the motion? Any objection? All right, the motion is carried without objection, and Senate Bill 686 is transferred to the Rules Committee without recommendation. Thank you, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I was looking forward to getting it done here today, too, Representative Bowman. This closes the work session on Senate Bill 686. We will now move into work session on Senate Bill 685. Council, where are we on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, we have already had a brief public hearing on this bill, and the committee has before it the Dash A4 amendments, which I believe came from Dennis Mulvihill and some other people, and I understand that there is some agreement between various parties on the A4 amendments. Approximately 5 to 10 minutes ago, we received the A5 amendments. I did not request those, and I believe that Representative Bowman may be able to answer some questions about what those do, but I haven't had a chance to look at them.
All right. First of all, I see Reed Richin and Mary Botkin both available to speak if needed. Why don't I ask both of you to come up, please? Together is fine. And speak to us about your perspective on this bill. Ms. Botkin, good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. You know, we have been working with a work group all session on the delineation of what corrections techs can do, cannot do, what parole officers are responsible for or not responsible for, what a certified person can or cannot do. And to be really quite frank with the committee, we have just simply spun our wheels in trying to find solutions to issues that are in court as we speak. And last week we kind of did the memorial service in our efforts to find a solution. We cannot seem to come up with the definitive answer that answers everybody's concerns, and when you get to that point, sometimes you're better off just letting the courts finish their deliberations and move ahead. And as you know, Mr. Chair, I dislike lists in law, because as duties change in the public safety arena, and they do, whatever is not on the list is, by virtue of its being eliminated, tacitly okay. And when you have lists in the law, it just opens up the whole issue to more and more litigation, and certainly no offense to any of the lawyers on this panel, but our lawyers make enough money off of us on litigation, I don't need to create more for them. And I'd be just as happy if we did nothing at this point.
What about Senate Bill 685 itself?
685 itself is the part-time issue and the amendments that Mr. Mulvihill produced.
The dash four?
The dash four amendments are okay.
All right, so you're okay with 685 and the dash four amendments.
Right.
Now, these dash five amendments which arrived to the committee this morning, what's your position on those?
Been there, done that all session. This
relates to the issues which are unresolved at this time.
Yes.
In a minute, I'll be asking Mr. DeLashmit. In fact, Mr. DeLashmit, why don't you come up, too? But first, I'll ask Mr. Ritchie to make his remarks, if you would.
Good morning, Chair Mannix, members of the committee. My name is Reed Ritchie. I'm the Assistant Director of Washington County Community Corrections, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. And I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 685, and I've only seen the dash four amendments. I haven't had the opportunity of seeing the dash five amendments this morning, but with the dash four amendments, we're certainly in favor of those. And what it does is it allows community corrections programs like ours to hire part-time probation and parole officers. That's something that's available to most professions, and for us, having the ability to hire part-time probation and parole officers, and what the statute does, it allows them to maintain their certification.
And I don't think there's any opposition to that basic bill.
And we certainly remain in favor of that.
And you're okay on that bill with the dash four. You have not seen the dash five.
That's correct.
All right.
Mr. Chair, if I might ask.
Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could ask Mary. Mary, I'm under the impression that the dash five was what the work group agreed to. There was only one outstanding issue, and that was an issue that was brought forth by the sheriff in Multnomah County. That's the issue I understood was the sticking point, and the rest of these were things that were agreed to in the work group, even though I was a part of it and didn't come. Wasn't invited, I should say.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, the sheriff's issue is a fairly significant sticking point.
Okay.
And
which is why it's not here.
Well, let me give you.
Well, and they're not here and don't know about it, and so I'm a little concerned.
Well, having just seen the A5 amendments myself, I'll tell you about the kind of problem I see from the lawyer's perspective. I see here a person who is not certified as a parole and probation officer may not perform searches and seizures. I already can see the motion to suppress evidence because in some situation, somehow, somewhere, someone who wasn't certified found themselves in a situation to pick up something and look at it or look inside it, and it turned out to be key evidence, and all of a sudden we have a motion to suppress because this person violated a statutory prohibition, which is an effective way of keeping out evidence. So I just say that I would want to be able to evaluate the implication of these kinds of provisions before I'd be willing to put knots into the law. I understood from some more recent discussions that the preference might be to talk about what a non-certified person may do, as opposed to what they may not do, which avoids those kinds of complications. That's why I understood there was some need for further discussion about these issues. Mr. DeLashmit, hi.
Mr. DeLashmit, representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, let me first say that I was not aware that there was going to be any additional discussions. No one had filled me in on that. A4s are fine. They've been agreed to by everybody. That just, it's basically technical cleanup. The A5s is, in fact, 686 with a number of the agreements that were brought forward on the listing. But in answer to Representative Bowman's question about the agreement and the issue of the sheriffs, the issue there actually is so intertwined and so parallel with the issues involved in here. For an example, a facility, a new entity type of facility that's being created in some counties. You may have parole and probation officers, which partially staff that. You may have correctional officers, partially staff that. You may have techs that staff that. And the issue that we started to find ourselves in as we went through this was that you had unlicensed or uncertified personnel doing certain tasks that could be done by parole and probation officers or correctional officers, but shouldn't be done by unlicensed personnel. So every time we took a step on parole and probation, we found the exact parallel issue with unlicensed and correctional officers. And so we decided at that point that we needed to take a bigger look at the kind of the entire structure. And that was my understanding of what we were going to step back and do, try and get all the parties together during the interim, not only on the parole and probation side, but on the correctional officer side and the counties, and come to some bigger solution to the issue than just this one piece.
Well, we'll still have a couple of vehicles with relating clauses in various places, including Ways and Means. That, having been through a meeting at Ways and Means, I was able to get some people some good news, including Ms. Granger from the Attorney General's office about particular bills, but other bills are probably bad news because of their fiscal impact, but some of them have very useful relating clauses, one of my favorite little things. And it's always possible that if we end up tied up in lengthy budget negotiations that some of us will have some spare time and could sit down and try to finalize some of these through some agreement that's universally at least acquiesced in as opposed to desired. But certainly that this, we're still at a rough stage done with these A5s as far as you're concerned.
Mr. Chair, as far as we're concerned, I mean, I just sat through the discussion down in Ways and Means on what 1145 really meant. And, you know, as you know, in the middle of 1145, we created a whole new facility that we don't even know what it looks like yet. We don't know what it is or who it's going to house for sure. And I think the sheriff's concerns are very legitimate concerns. And I noticed that Russ Spencer from the sheriff's lobby, just the sheriff's lobbyist, just walked in.
And he covered his face as you mentioned his name.
And I do think that, I mean, I do think this is a not contentious but complicated issue to deal with. And lists make it a little more complicated or not. I mean,
and the point is we have some people of good faith here trying to work together, but haven't quite gotten there. Okay. On the other hand, we have a bill that otherwise is ready to roll. And we do have some relating clauses in the closet, so to speak. Representative Hansen.
What are the downsides if we do nothing this session on this issue and let it be resolved during the interim? Are there any really critical issues out there that we're doing, thinking in terms of
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think there's very little in the downside part. I think we're going to do business as we're doing it now, and it will give us an opportunity to more fully understand what the facilities are that Multnomah County is intending to build and to operate and what the population mix will look like and whether they're going to be more of a non-security housing facility or if they will have a more secure environment. I mean, I just don't know. I don't think we know exactly what it is they want to do yet. And we're prepared to be very cautious about proceeding forward on legislation before we know what these facilities look like.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary, it's interesting that that's what's holding up this bill, because that issue has been resolved by the Multnomah County Commission and the Sheriff's Office. And every time it gets resolved, we end up down here in session trying to change the resolution. So it makes me a little nervous that we're debating a facility that the decision has already been made, what kind of facility that will be. So that's what's holding up the process, that one decision that's already been confirmed by the Sheriff and the Board of County Commissioners, then that's a non-issue.
Okay.
Chair Mannix, Representative Bowman, if I may. I guess first I'd like to say that I hope this discussion doesn't somehow hold up Senate Bill 685, because I'd certainly like to see that move forward, because there doesn't seem to be any opposition to that. But with regard to the Dash 5 amendments, I think that certainly some of the duties, the exceptions that have been outlined in this amendment, have been generally supported by the directors and were part of the discussions that went on before. But the directors have serious concerns about the sheriff's amendments and especially the financial impact that that could have on community corrections programs that operate their own work release restitution centers, and the additional requirements that that would put on those programs. And so we have very significant concerns about that.
All right. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair would entertain a motion that we adopt the A4 amendments to Senate Bill 685.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Gianella moves that we adopt the A4 amendments. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing no objection, the A4 amendments are adopted. Chair would entertain a motion that Senate Bill 685 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Representative Gianella so moves. Discussion? I agree with Representative Bowman. We ought to keep working on these issues, and there's no reason why we should stop working on them in this session, but we do have some other vehicles available. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing no objection, the motion is carried. Senate Bill 685 is sent to the floor with a due pass. I'll go ahead and carry that, unless someone really wants to. All right, I'll carry the bill. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 685. We now move into public hearing on Senate Bill 392. Yeah, we'll send. Thank you. I'll start off with Bob Rockland from the Department of Justice. Good morning. Why don't I invite up to then John Bradley at the same time? And John Hoover. We'll make it a trio here. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Rockland. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Appellate Division with the Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 392 and the Dash 1, Dash 2, and Dash 3 amendments. I also would like to point out that I'm going to propose an amendment orally today to the Dash 3 amendments. There's one word change that I think Legislative Council erred in putting in there. As a little bit of background, this bill stems from last session's House Bill 2317. That bill was discussed by all the interested parties, the defense bar, the courts. Everybody had a hand in the final version of that bill. It ended up not passing, and it was resurrected by the Department of Justice this session. Senate Bill 392, the existing bill, is addressed to three major areas. The biggest part of the bill, which is found in sections 2, 3, and 4, has to do with codifying a procedure after a person is convicted of aggravated murder and sentenced to death, and their conviction and sentence are affirmed by the Supreme Court on automatic review. The question is, what happens then? And we found during the procedures involving Harry Moore and Douglas Wright that not much of this was codified, and we ran into some issues about just exactly what rules applied. The intent of Sections 2, 3, and 4 generally is simply to codify a procedure so that we can determine what the person wants to do. That is, does the person want to challenge the conviction, or does the person want to become a so-called volunteer? Is the person competent to waive counsel? Is the person mentally eligible under the Eighth Amendment to be executed? So that's what the biggest part of the bill is about. I guess the other major part of the existing bill is found in Section 7, which provides for what are called next friend petitions and post-conviction relief. This stems from the fact that under the current statute, if a person who has been convicted of a crime and wants to seek post-conviction relief, if that person, due to mental incapacity, can't file a petition for post-conviction relief on his or her own behalf, there's no current procedure for someone else to do it. And what this does is codify the federal standards for what are called next tran petitions. That is, if the person, due to mental incapacity or lack of access to the courts, cannot file a post-conviction relief petition, Section 7 of the existing bill allows for somebody to do it on his or her behalf. That's the bill as it exists. There's a lot more in there. There's some more general provisions about return of a death warrant and other matters, but that's the guts of the bill. With respect to the amendments, I'd like to start for a moment with the Dash 3 amendments because I think those are the simplest. Under the current version of the bill, if at the death warrant hearing the defendant is found not to be able to understand the nature of the death penalty and its implications, under the Eighth Amendment, that person cannot be executed. The current bill says if that finding is made at the death warrant hearing, that the judge simply doesn't issue a death warrant, but it doesn't say what you do then. The Dash 3 amendments simply provide for a periodic review of this decision. So, for example, if the person 6 months later or a year later is in better shape mentally, one of the parties can raise this issue again to the court and say, we think now he's able to understand the nature of the death sentence and its implications, and we'd like to have the court reconsider that.
There was a one-word change you were going to recommend.
And the one-word change is on line 6 of the Dash 3 amendments. I think the current word is shall, it is may, and our intent was that that should be shall. That is, upon motion of the district attorney, defense counsel, or the court's own motion, the court shall hold a hearing to look into this matter again.
That was originally what was intended with this amendment, but that came out with the may instead.
That's correct.
All right. So if we decide to proceed with this, we'll treat that as a Scrivener's error. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Mannix. That is the Dash 3 amendments, simply to provide for periodic review of that issue. I guess I'd like to turn then to the Dash 1 amendments, and these resulted just from additional review of the existing bill. They're primarily clarifications, and I'll point out a few points about these amendments. One of the complicated things about this bill is that there are two kinds of mental states and mental capacity inquiries that are made. One is the ability to, say, waive counsel and decide not to challenge your conviction, and the other is whether because of mental incapacity, you don't understand the death sentence and its implications. And those are two separate inquiries. And there are places in the bill where the language kind of overlaps a little bit. So the Dash 1 amendments, one of the main purposes is to make sure that those are two separate inquiries and that it's clear. So the issue of are you mentally capable of deciding to waive counsel or deciding not to file a post-conviction relief, it's amended to now consistently refer to that as mental capacity to engage in reasoned choices of legal strategies and options. So that really is simply a clarification. The other clarification that I think is worthy of note is in Section 4 of the current bill, that's the provision that says if the person suffers from a mental condition that prevents him from comprehending the reasons for the death sentence and its implications, the court shall not issue a death warrant. What this amendment does is clarify that the burden of proof on that issue is on the defendant, and it's by a simple preponderance of the evidence. That is, a defendant must prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he's not capable of understanding the reasons for the death sentence and its implication. That's really just a clarification since there was no burden of proof or level of proof before. In a similar vein, on the next friend provisions in Section 7 of the bill, the Dash 1 amendments would change those to add a burden of proof and level of proof also, so that if somebody says, I need to file a petition for post-conviction relief on this person's behalf because this person is not capable, the person who wants to file the petition must show by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant is incapable of doing it on his own.
So the bias there is in favor of the defendant taking care of his own business, and if someone else wants to intervene, they're going to have a highest civil level of evidence in order to be able to intervene.
That's correct, Chair Mannix.
Not intervene, actually, take over.
Right. And this is the kind of issue that especially arises with respect to volunteers, people who don't want to, for example, Harry Moore, who was mentally capable of making the choice and did not want to pursue anything, and people were trying to come in on his behalf. And this addresses that by saying the person has a choice of what he wants to do. He's autonomous. And only if you show by clear and convincing evidence that he's incapable of making these decisions can you then come in and do something on his behalf.
In a perverse way, you might say, in the state that has physician-assisted suicide, we also allow people on death row to go through their own form of suicide. They can choose not to challenge the approach.
That's correct, and the choice should be theirs unless there's some convincing reason that they're incapable of making that choice.
President Giannello.
From Dash 1 Amendment, line 40, says delete line 40. Does that also include the line before, the end of the line before where it says P-E-R, that partial word?
That's a reference actually to page 5 of the bill. So we're actually referring to another page, not page 1 of the bill.
Right.
On page 5.
Yes, you're right.
The reference to delete line 40. It's actually just a change of line 40. What's on line 16 and 17 of page 1 of the Dash 1 amendments would go in instead of line 40 of page 5 of the bill. No, it'll pick up with perform. They've left in form. It's actually going to be perform.
Okay.
An assessment of the defendant's mental capacity to engage in reasoned choices of legal strategies and options, if, and then the colon. So it was picking up on the perform.
Okay.
Word. Please go ahead.
I'd be happy to answer any questions about those two sets of amendments, if there are any now, because then I want to move into the Dash 2 amendments, which is where we might say is the meat of the amendments here.
Go ahead.
The Dash 2 amendments actually add significant new provisions to the bill. As a little bit of background, the whole point of the Dash 2 amendments is simply to eliminate undue delay in post-conviction cases involving death row inmates, and the Dash 2 amendments apply only to death row inmates, not to other convicted criminals. The point here is that the biggest delay in people going through the system on who have death sentences appears to be, at least in this state right now, in the post-conviction area. And I'd like to give a couple of examples, and they're mentioned in my written testimony. We have 8 people on death row right now who have filed petitions for post-conviction relief. And of those 8, one of them, for example, is Jesse Pratt. He was convicted and sentenced to death in 1991, April of 1991. He has since gone through the direct review procedure. And by the way, at the end of my written testimony, there's a chart that shows the levels of review for a death sentence. Anyway, Jesse Pratt has gone through the direct review procedure and has filed a post-conviction petition. He filed his petition in 1993 in the Marion County Circuit Court. That petition is still pending. So it's been over 6 years that Jesse Pratt has been in the trial court, in the post-conviction court, with basically nothing happened, amended petitions, delays, and so on. Now,
what you're trying to say in a nice way is, if I were the defense attorney, the name of the game, my objective is to keep my client alive as long as possible. If I think I could somehow get my client off the hook, I'll try to do that. But in the meantime, I want to delay the process. Not illegally, not unethically, not unprofessionally, but I want to delay the process. And there are, to any given lawyer, 1,001 ways to delay, and you're trying to put some time frames in here so that when you run through the delay game, you do run into some end games with time frames.
That's correct, Chair Mannix. The point is that right now the current statutes pretty much leave up to the post-conviction trial judge the number of amendments and how long you have to amend the petition and so on. And there are really no statutory time frames. What the Dash 2 amendments do is add some statutory time frames, but they also affect the process a little bit differently. Currently, it's a serial process. You finish your direct review, then you file a petition for post-conviction relief. Under the Dash 2 amendments, the petition for post-conviction relief has to be filed while the direct review proceeding is pending.
If you already know about your issue for post-conviction relief, why wait for the direct review to be over when, right now, I guess the argument would be, well, we never know what will happen on the direct review, but the other point is that this is a post-conviction issue. If it's a legitimate post-conviction issue, go ahead and get it raised and get it in process.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. There's really no reason to delay. You should know by the time that the appellant's brief is filed in the Supreme Court on direct review what issues there are that you have with trial counsel or with your trial that you think are properly raised. The other point about these amendments is that if a post-conviction petitioner really does have a basis for relief, there's no reason that there should be delays. That person is entitled to relief quickly, and what these amendments do is provide time frames that we think are reasonable, that prevent undue delay, but also give enough time for the post-conviction petitioner to know what the issues are and raise them properly.
In the hypothetical case where there's a legitimate post-conviction relief issue, why should the person languish on death row? Let him get his day in court, let him get his post-conviction relief, and it may release him, it may mitigate, or whatever. That's your point?
That's
or
correct.
It also may simply mean that he doesn't really have an issue, so let's get it over with.
That's correct. It seems to me, Chair Manager, that nobody benefits from delays that are there simply for the purpose of delay.
All right. Dr. Bowman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It appears that you're assuming that inmates have the same legal knowledge that we have an expectation that lawyers would have, whether that's a defense or a prosecuting attorney. How would this information be disseminated so that that inmates would know what their rights are and how that process works?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, my experience in post-conviction cases, well, let me back up for a second. The way it works normally is that the inmate will file what's called an informal petition that basically says something like, in plain language, my lawyer didn't call these witnesses who I wanted called. And he knows that. I mean, he doesn't really need to be schooled in legal issues to know that. And then what happens is counsel is appointed, and counsel then goes and talks to the petitioner, and they file an amended or formal petition. So in terms of the questions, and I've also read many transcripts of depositions of post-conviction petitioners, and what happens is a post-conviction petitioner pretty much knows, you know, gee, my lawyer didn't do this, he didn't object to this hearsay. The general idea that something untoward has happened or that your lawyer didn't represent you well, inmates tend to know that, and they have a chance once they articulate it in a general way to then have a lawyer and articulate it in a more legally appropriate way.
One might also pose the concept that swiftness is important because if a witness wasn't called, you'd want that issue raised promptly while the witness might still be available as opposed to wait 6 years and the person may have died or moved to Timbuktu.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The burden of proof in a post-conviction case is on the petitioner. It's not like a criminal case. Petitioner has to prove that he's entitled to relief, and in doing so, he normally will have to, for example, say, my lawyer didn't call witness X, and therefore I'm entitled to relief. Normally, he'll have to prove what witness X would have said, so he needs access to witness X to testify in the post-conviction proceeding. And again, speeding matters up and makes witnesses more available, as the chair mentioned.
Are there other detailed points you want to make about the Dash 2 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I think there's really only two things I want to point out about the Dash 2 amendments. One, and they're actually two versions of the same thing. There are two what are basically called escape clauses in here to deal with the situation where a post-conviction petitioner can't raise something that he wants to raise. The first one is an escape clause that says instead of filing your petition within 60 days, you can file it later if you become aware of something that you reasonably could not have known about on a subsequent petition. So, for example, if some witness shows up or something like that, the 60-day period doesn't apply. You can file a subsequent petition. The other escape clause is with regard to a petition that has been filed, and that allows you to amend the petition to include another claim if you can show extraordinary circumstances that could not have been foreseen and prevented. So if something else comes to your attention while the petition is still pending, you can amend it under those circumstances. And I believe that's all I have for now, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Mr. Bradley, good morning.
Mr. Chair, I want to talk briefly about the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments, and I'll start with Dash 3. The reason why the Dash 3 amendments are important is because they set up a procedure where somebody is fighting. They're trying to litigate it. Senate Bill 392, for the most part, may be real helpful for somebody who wants to have the death penalty imposed. But if somebody's opposed to it, there are going to be hearings on it. And what the Dash 3 amendment does is it tries to set up a procedure whereby we know what the procedures are, and we know what the rights of the parties are, and we know what the burdens are. I think it's very, very important to establish a procedure here. This is just from a practical standpoint of when we go before the judge, you know, what's the hearing going to be? You know, what's going to be the basis of the hearing? Because without it, you're going to have every single court in the state will have different little procedures. And I think there's something beneficial to have one uniform procedure statewide. I think one of the important things, there are two important things in sub C and sub D. One is the state can request a medical or a psychological or psychiatric evaluation. Without that, my guess is some of your courts would hold that that right didn't exist. We wanted to make that very specific. The other is this. The burden is on the defendant by the preponderance to show that the mental disease or defect. Now,
we understand that.
But the reason why that's important is this. In many cases, if a court makes a finding that the defendant suffers from a mental disease and doesn't understand this, and then after that the defendant doesn't want to cooperate anymore with any psychologist or psychiatrist and says, I'm not going to say anything, my guess is most attorneys would tell the
burden's on him. It won't do him any good not to cooperate.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that's the basis for that. As far as the Dash 2 amendments, again, I think Representative Bowman has a point. I think that's easily remedied because at the time someone is convicted, they are given their rights of appeal. Every time someone's convicted and a sentence is given, they're given a piece of paper which establishes their right of appeal. There's no reason why, if this is adopted, there's no reason we couldn't change that law also.
Is there anybody presently on death row who's not represented by counsel?
Representative Manich, I think that when you said represented by counsel...
But who's had representation by counsel for every single judicial proceeding that they wanted it on?
Everyone has been represented by counsel, and all of the eight death row inmates who are presently in the post-conviction process all are represented by counsel.
Now, as a practical matter, that's the case. Now, theoretically, someone could have refused representation. Representative Bowman's point is always they can ask for counsel, but they also need to be able to present themselves to the court. Your counterpoint is they can, in plain English, raise their issues. My lawyer screwed up. He should have called this witness, or he should have objected to this. But they can also ask for counsel to represent them as to those alleged screw-ups at state expense if they can't afford it.
That's correct.
The importance of this issue about expediting post-conviction relief, and it's one of the reasons Mr. Hoover's here, is with the passage of time, our experience has been in post-conviction relief, is that the truth gets lost. I mean, the truth is the victim to the passage of time in these matters. One of the things about death penalty cases is that they are the hardest, both emotionally and almost physically, of the kinds of cases you try. They take oftentimes more than a month, sometimes up to 4 or 5 months to try. There are things that when the parties are done with it, they want to forget about it. And with the passage of time, people forget what happened in a proceeding. And it's not... We used to have, in this state, in post-conviction relief, we had unlimited time for filing it. And I'll never forget what would happen is 7 or 8 years after someone was convicted, I'd have deputies come up to me and say, this person has filed a post-conviction relief, and this case was 7 or 8 years ago, and I can't remember anything about it. And that's the same thing's true with the defense attorneys. After the passage of that much time, you know, why they did something on a particular day, why they didn't ask a question, those kinds of inquiries that are made, that the longer the time goes by, the more likely it is that people are going to forget. It's important to have these things done in an expeditious manner. And the other thing is this. If there is some basis for the post-conviction relief, it is important to litigate this sooner rather than later, because if somebody wasn't given counsel, wasn't given adequate, you know, who didn't do a good job, that ought to be remedied sooner rather than later. And that's the importance of the Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there, I guess, let me figure out how to ask this question. I'm trying to figure out how many times does a court rule that, in fact, the counsel was not, in fact, good, and therefore, I mean, is that something that happens like once in a blue moon, or is that something that happens on a regular basis? What's your sense for how that process currently works?
Chair Mannix, Representative Bowman, I would turn that over to Mr. Hoover and Mr. Rockland.
And by the way, I'm going to ask you gentlemen to expedite your remarks. I'm watching that clock because there's a session starting at 10 o'clock, and I have other witnesses.
Chairman Mannix, Representative Bowman, the answer to the question is that, you know, my job is obviously to win post-conviction, and I defend the trial counsel for the defendant, which is an unusual situation, but part of the difficulty we do have is with the passage of time, the court tends to rely upon, you know, the attorneys and what they say they recall more and more. So their counsel is not found to be incompetent that often. You're dealing with an older record. So in a sense, this would benefit a defendant who knows at the time of his conviction his attorney did something wrong. He can get that before the court more quickly, and I don't want to say that, you know, if there's a possibility that the attorney did something wrong, the time to get that before the court is when memories are fresh and the evidence is fresh. So to answer your question specifically, at this point, it is not that often in Multnomah County that trial counsel are found incompetent. That's my experience. I don't have anything else to say unless there are any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Clarence and Kathleen Pugh, Marion County. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
I was on pins and needles waiting for my wife to arrive, too, so that she could be here. I would have thought that after 33 years of marriage, however, that we would probably pretty much know how we think. My name is Clarence Pugh, and I live in Salem. We're here representing the Oregon Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And our coalition, among others, includes the Oregon-Idaho Conference of the United Methodist Church, the Oregon Catholic Conference, and the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom. We recognize Senate Bill 6392 as passed by the Oregon Senate as legislation needed to clarify existing law regarding the imposition of a death sentence and the issuance of death warrants. We also appreciate the inclusion of Next Friend petitions for post-conviction relief in death penalty cases. Our understanding is that this procedure follows what is held in federal law. Our specific reason for coming to you today is to ask that you leave the timelines for post-conviction relief as they currently stand. At the point that the timelines are used, the defendant is incarcerated and the public is safe from any threat that the defendant might have presented in the past. The question then becomes, does doubt remain that this person whom we will execute has been fairly tried, is competent to participate in reasoned choices on his behalf, and is guilty of the crime with which he or she was convicted. In the past 20 years in the United States, at least 78 men and women who were on death rows in various states have been released from prison. They were flat innocent. Only last November, that number stood at 75. Since then, another 3 death row inmates have been released. These numbers do not include people who have been wrongly executed, at least 23 in this century. Simply being innocent is not enough. Advances in technology are making it possible to revisit crimes. Diligent investigation by families and other supporters is finding evidence of police and prosecutorial misconduct. In some cases, evidence is found long after convictions, and in more and more cases, people who were accused, tried, and convicted are being found innocent. Oregon is no stranger to this phenomenon.
Mr. Pugh, you have some written testimony. Normally, we ask that you just summarize what your written testimony says, and then you could submit that to us. If you don't have copies, that's all right. Normally, we ask for 25 copies of written testimony, and we'd be happy to have you summarize it and then submit the written testimony for the record.
Thank you. I do have copies, and I'll provide those. I will summarize it. There are 5 people who have been released from prison in Oregon, at least 5. And the 5 will be mentioned in my testimony, who have been released from prison in Oregon because they were innocent. And shortening or restricting unduly the amount of time that a person has to appeal an execution is going to cause people in Oregon to be executed who are innocent people. There's nobody in this room, I'm quite sure, who can swear that there isn't somebody who either is innocent or is likely to be innocent or will be innocent in the future. We just can't know that because we're just all human. And we will make mistakes. So that's our testimony. We do not feel that that can be done. I would just say one other thing. As of June 9th, 1999, there are 103 people in Oregon who are either under sentence of death or who have been sentenced to life without parole. Those 5 people represent nearly 5% of that number. With a 5% error rate, then you just cannot guarantee that by shortening the amount of time that is available for appeal is going to improve the record. That's what I have.
Did you want to add some remarks too?
No, that's fine. That's our testimony.
Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Janelle has a question.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Pugh, you said there were 75 inmates were released in the last 20 years on death row, and 5 were released in Oregon because they were innocent. You know what the time frame for that was?
Of the 5 people?
Right.
It's been since the 2 of them, a man named Jeffrey Boots and a man named Eric Proctor, were convicted in 1984. That was during a time when Oregon did not have a death penalty statute because it was under review. In fact, I think it had been thrown out and it had to be reinstated. So they were not under sentence of death. If we had had the death penalty in 1984, it's quite likely that they would have been because the crime that they were accused of was a very heinous crime. And so that was those 2. There were 2 other people, a woman named...
I think all 5 of them have been released since 1991.
Yeah.
So it's been in 8 years, I guess, that those 5 have been released, yes.
Thank you very much. Ann Christian and Keith Garzani. Is it Garza? I'm sorry. Garza. I started to read something else here. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
I see you're neutral on this bill. Do you have any technical comments?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ann Christian, Indigent Defense Services Director with the Oregon Judicial Department. With me today is Keith Garza, who is the counsel to the Supreme Court. And I will be brief, Mr. Chair. The Judicial Department takes no position on the original bill, Senate Bill 392, the dash one, the dash two, or the dash three amendments. I'm here, and Mr. Garza is here, let me say, to answer any questions that the committee members may have concerning the Supreme Court process in dealing with death sentence cases. Mr. Rockland indicated a bill back in 1997, 2317, which is, in my estimation, the original 392, was agreed to by a group of individuals. That bill, in fact, Mr. Garza's predecessor with the Supreme Court, and I served on that work group, and so we have not even appeared on the Senate side on this matter. I'll briefly address an issue regarding provision of counsel with respect to the Dash 2 amendments. As has been indicated, the Dash 2 amendments set up a process that has timelines within which petitions for post-conviction relief must be filed and any amended petitions be filed. The current system where an individual is sentenced to death, there is an automatic review appeal to the Supreme Court. The state public defender, in the vast, vast majority of cases, in all of those cases in which there is not a direct actual conflict of interest, it's the state public defender's office who is representing that individual before the Supreme Court. The Dash 2 amendments would provide that the petition for post-conviction relief would have to be filed within 60 days of the state public defender, in the vast, vast majority of the cases, having filed their brief. The state public defender will have reviewed the transcript, obviously, in order to file that appellate brief with the Supreme Court. The short answer to the chair's questions as far as technical issues is, if the state public defender's office were allowed under this bill to represent the individual who is going, would be going in a dual track, if the state public defender, who has already read the transcript, could be allowed to file the petition for post-conviction relief, I had written down, if someone had asked me how to streamline the system, I would suggest a dual track with the state public defender representing the petitioner on post-conviction relief.
Instead of someone else coming in?
Excuse me?
Instead of someone else coming in?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The current process is that the state public defender, again, unless they have a conflict, represents on automatic review on the appeal, and the state public defender does not represent on a petition for post-conviction relief.
Could I suggest that we look at fixing that in a bill that we have pending in front of the Ways and Means Committee relating to indigent defense?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to, and I thought today when I appeared that my testimony would be even briefer because I did take some time to speak with Mr. Rockland and Mr. Bradley to suggest the state public defender is the answer. And Mr. Rockland pointed out to me on page 9, section 8, subsection 9, a problem with my proposed solution. Mr. Chair, if there's a possibility that there will be a future hearing,
there will not be. If we can move this bill, if it's going to move, it will move today. I don't have permission to have this committee open another day.
No, I understand that. I thought there was a potential that it might go to the Rules Committee, and I just...
Well, it will if we have problems with this bill. If there's external new ideas that are to be added, they can be added in another bill that we have pending in front of Ways and Means if there are these kinds of adjustments, and we'd welcome that. There is a vehicle for other things. I just want to make sure this package doesn't get diverted because one never knows what happens in Ways and Means either.
I understand, Mr. Chair. I have nothing further. I would note that the state public defender obviously is not here, and I have not had an opportunity to discuss this motion with Mr. Groom. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Looks like we have no questions.
Thank you
very much. Ingrid Swenson and Ingrid McFarland. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. Rockman is correct that we, as an organization, had concurred in the language of Senate Bill 392. And he's also correct in that we spent a significant amount of time during the 1997 session working on this measure. A lot of people were involved, a lot of interests were represented, a lot of hard work was done, and when we came to the end of that process, we thought we had a fairly good product that honored the input of all of the people who participated. I therefore think it odd that we are here today looking at significant amendments, which we saw for the first time yesterday, despite the lengthy process that has gone on. The hearing in the Senate on this bill took place in February of this year, and presumably these amendments have been in the works for some time. We have not seen them. As the chair is aware, most of our members are out of town this week. Our annual conference is being held in Bend, and I think all of the members of this committee were invited, but obviously you couldn't make it either. And consequently, many of the people who would be intensely interested in this issue have not even seen the proposed amendments or heard about them. We're fortunate in that Ingrid McFarland from the State Public Defender's Office was in town and was able to make a quick review of these and does have some comments for the committee this morning.
Let me interrupt you for a moment and ask this question. You did approach me yesterday and advised me that there were these new amendments, and you asked, you mentioned that the criminal defense lawyers were largely out of town in Bend. At that time, I offered to send this bill to the Rules Committee. If you told me this morning that you couldn't have folks in prepared to talk about the substance of the amendments, I want to make it clear for the record that we're not trying to ram this thing through. Are you saying now that you've not had enough time to carefully evaluate these amendments and that you need more time?
Mr. Chair, I think our situation is this. I mean, I believe that Ingrid McFarland is well qualified to address some of the major issues. I think we have testimony which would possibly influence this committee to want some significant amendments, and if the committee decides that amendments are appropriate, obviously that's a difficulty if this is a final meeting of your committee.
Well, we'll have to wait and see then. Go ahead.
I'd like to start briefly with the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, Mr. Chair, Dash 3. With the Dash 1 amendments, some of that is...
Let me do this.
Yes.
You're not going to be able to say at the end of this discussion this morning that you've had full and fair opportunity to evaluate these amendments and comment on them. Isn't that a fair statement?
I'm going to say that Ms. McFarland and I have done the best we could, but we do have other members who...
Well, here's what we're going to do then. We're going to send this bill to Rules. I'll ask our members in a minute whether they want to adopt these amendments. So I'm going to, I'm going to ask you to give a brief presentation about your concerns about the amendments to see whether we want to adopt them before we send this bill to Rules. I want to hear from Mr. Castagna because he's here to testify this morning. I do not want to rush through amendments without giving folks a full chance to evaluate them. That's important. The amendments that I have in front of me, however, are not dated yesterday. And so you're saying you didn't have them before yesterday?
That's correct.
They're dated May 25, May 27, and June 7. Were they publicly available before yesterday, Mr. Horton?
They were not, Mr. Chairman.
All right. So what we're going to do is take your best shot here. I'm not going to ask this committee to adopt amendments until they've had full commentary, and I don't want to waste time. Only two members of this committee serve on Rules. And since you're going to have to make this pitch to Rules, it's going to waste some other people's time to some extent. I'm not going to ask us to adopt amendments that haven't been fully evaluated. So, in fact, as I'm talking, I'm also thinking, I'm not going to waste your time this morning. I want to hear from Mr. Castagna about his philosophical objection to the bill. I ask you to defer your testimony to the Rules Committee. Then you'll be able to come in and make a full presentation. I'm going to ask Mr. Rockland and Mr. Bradley and Mr. Hoover to come to the Rules Committee also and be prepared to make their pitch. And, of course, other witnesses who may want to come in. I see that we have a representative of the ACLU here. He may want to make some remarks. But to be blunt about it, I want to be efficient and fair.
And I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if we could take maybe 5 minutes of your time just to outline our major concerns. I think
it
would be of interest. With respect to Dash 1, our major concern is with the change of standard with respect to Section 7 of the bill, which would raise it from preponderance to clear and convincing when someone is seeking to represent the defendant's interests. You heard about that from the proponents. That's our major concern with the Dash 1s. I want to talk quickly about the Dash 3s, and then I'll ask Ingrid McFarland to talk about the Dash 2s. In the Dash 3s, especially if the language is changed...
May I interrupt something else before I forget? I just had to point out, these were not amendments that this office requested or the committee requested, and I want it understood in the record. We weren't holding something back. They were just brought to us, and I apologize to the chief for the fact that she didn't have a chance to see them.
Thank you, Mr. Please. Chair. We understood that. With respect to the Dash 3s, particularly if the committee makes the change which Mr. Bradley suggested, Mr. Rockland suggested, requiring that the court conduct subsequent hearings upon the motion of any party rather than giving the court that discretion, in essence, you would be having a hearing every 6 months. There is no threshold presented, nothing whatsoever in terms of what would be required to be shown in order for there to be a hearing, so that the defendant who was found incapable of understanding what the death penalty was about may have deteriorated, may have stayed exactly the same, and yet the court under this construction would not have the ability to say, no, I'm not going to have another trial. We just had a trial. Nothing's changed.
Let me interrupt you again then. Have you had a conversation with Mr. Rockland or Mr. Bradley or Mr. Hoover about these kinds of issues?
I have had no opportunity to do that.
Then I am going to stop us, even though I said 5 minutes. I think you really ought to have that conversation, and so should Ingrid McFarland, because we are not going to adopt amendments today. It may turn out that there may be some modifications to these amendments that would make this discussion moot. And the reason I don't want to be, shall we say, rude, but because I'm watching the clock, session started at 10. We could be called out of here at any moment on a call of the House. I'm sensitive to getting the action completed. Let me hear briefly from Ms. McFarland. You've done us the courtesy of being here. Is there a couple of high points you would like to make?
Yes, regarding, I'm one of the attorneys at the State Public Defender's Office, one of the three that handles the direct appeals of the capital cases. Regarding the attempt to create a simultaneous post-conviction process and direct appellate review process, there's a major problem in that it would preclude a post-conviction claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. These death row inmates are entitled to review under statutory rule the work that we do. There are United States Supreme Court cases that say that arbitrary deprivation of a state right is a due process violation. Two, having the processes run at the same time creates a potential mootness problem for the post-conviction claims, which is a huge, possibly unnecessary expense.
Because if you win your appeal, then why worry about post-conviction? Is that your point?
Exactly.
Okay.
And then you've got a huge expense on this. Exactly. Even if you win only the sentencing part, you go back. Some men have spent time on death row. Even if they've only been entitled to then a new sentencing proceeding, they might take a deal that was offered the first time after they've been on death row. They don't want to go back there. And again,
you move on to your next point.
Okay. Three, there's another problem with equal privileges and immunities and equal protection in the federal constitution by creating a different process for post-conviction for death row inmates. And this is also as to elimination of the Court of Appeals review of post-conviction cases. You're denying a level of review to some aggravated murderers that's available to others, and there's a significant constitutional issue with that. In the interest of time, that's
thank you. I'm going to ask Mrs. Rockland, Bradley, and Hoover to discuss these issues with both of you and with other experts among the criminal defense lawyers over the next few days. I expect you'd see this coming up in rules fairly quickly, and you should be given a full and fair opportunity to comment on these issues in front of that committee.
Thank you
very much. And Ann Christian should be involved in that process, too. Mr. Castagna, I don't want to make you come back. You're welcome to have you come in, and I presume it's a philosophical position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference.
In part, my comments are philosophical, in part, my comments are procedural. The Oregon Catholic Conference adopts its public policy positions based upon a consistent ethic of life. The dignity and sanctity of human life is the cornerstone and the framework of the Oregon Catholic Conference adopting policies that it advocates in the public policy arena. So this session, we have been here on a whole host of issue areas: affordable housing, earned income tax credit, food stamps, partial birth abortion, assisted suicide. Today we're here on the death penalty. And it should come as no surprise to you what the position of the Oregon Catholic Conference is, philosophically, based upon our theological foundations, on the death penalty. As a matter of fact, on January the 27th, Pope John Paul II appeared in St. Louis, and he made a rather urgent message to the people of the United States. So the new evangelization calls for followers of Christ who are unconditionally pro-life, who will proclaim, celebrate, and serve the gospel of life in every situation. A sign of hope is the increasing recognition that the dignity of human life must never be taken away, even in the case of someone who has done great evil. Modern society has the means of protecting itself without definitively denying criminals the chance to reform. I renew the appeal I made most recently at Christmas for a consensus to end the death penalty, which is both cruel and unnecessary. In that context, given then the opposition of the Catholic Church to the death penalty, it would come as no surprise that the Church would oppose any procedural amendments to state or federal law that should facilitate or expedite the imposition of a death penalty sentence, which in the words of the Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, we find cruel and unnecessary. That's from a philosophical position based upon our theological understanding. Procedurally, I received a confidential communication at the beginning of this session from a source I will not identify, who told me that at the end of the session there would be attempts to amend the process for the death penalty, to expedite the death penalty. So that it comes as a great shock to me, and it should come as a scandal to this body, that if the criminal defense attorneys of this state have been involved in negotiations with the prosecutorial side, and the criminal defense attorneys were denied this information until the day before the hearing, that there is something terribly amiss in the process of trying to amend the process of the death penalty in this state. And that in and of itself should render the amendments to expedite the process extremely suspect. Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Castagna, since I noted that Ms. Swenson had advised me yesterday she'd only gotten those amendments, and I'd offer her the opportunity some additional time, I can't get into the motivation or malevolence or non-malevolence or non-machinations or machinations of others. All I can do is try to make sure the process that we control is fair and complete. And the way we can ensure that is to make sure we don't act on this bill today, but to have it set over, and if we can move it to the Rules Committee, so everyone has a chance for a complete opportunity to evaluate these amendments, which is what we will do. So we still control the process.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments, but again, if parties have been in dialogue for months or since last session, and at the 11th hour of this session for the amendments to be sprung upon them, it seems to me to be an unfair process for the people involved in the discussion.
We will remedy that defect.
Thank you.
All right, I'd entertain a motion that... We're not in work session yet. This concludes the public hearing on Senate Bill 392. We're in work session. I'd entertain a motion that Senate Bill 392 be forwarded to the Rules Committee with no recommendation.
So moved.
Representative Simmons moves that we forward it to the Rules Committee with no recommendation.
Objection?
Any objection to the motion? Hearing none? Yes, Representative.
Well, I object. I would vote no on the motion.
Let's have the clerk call the roll on the motion to refer to rules with no recommendation.
Representative Bowman?
Yes.
Representative Gianella?
Yes.
Representative Manson?
No.
Representative Simmons?
Aye.
Representative Perry?
Aye.
Chair
Mattis? Aye. Motion carries. The bill is referred to rules with no recommendation. This concludes the work session on Senate Bill 392, and we are adjourned. Thank you very much.